Ahoy, Vachon. How's the French say, Vachon? This is the Brown Briefly, where less is more, more or less, coming to you live over KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vachon, your island connection. Please make us part of your day. And be advised that our assertions and views, which can modestly be described as progressive persuasion, do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH or Voice of Vachon.
It is Tuesday, September 1st, 2020, in the year of the tweet. Whoops. Tweet, tweet, tweet. And the global pandemic. We're keeping Truman busy here with these crowd noises that you hear in the background. With us this morning, and all alone and playing the board and trying to keep up with us, is in the Gene Bosch studio in bustling and bodacious downtown Vachon, whilst the rest of us lounge comfortably at home in our PJs. Zooming into the show is our master of the virtual mix and Zoom modulating sound engineer, Truman O'Brien.
Wow. Sorry, I was just trying to get all the darn buttons pushed and I missed a couple. You can see me over here just trying to frantically get everything going here. But anyway, good morning. Good morning. Welcome.
Thank goodness we weren't in the airplane.
Well, that's for sure. Well, you usually have more time, you know, in the airplane. Well, usually. Not always.
Good to be with you.
You're muted, Susan.
Out of the land of magnolias and stuck home on the island of Madronas comes the analytic academic social worker, poet, backup singer, and former all-star shortstop for the Dixie Debutantes, Lynn Kerrigan. Kerrigan.
I'll get it. Okay, see, it's not just me.
Yeah, Lynn, you're muted, so we can't hear you. You're muted, Lynn. We're still struggling after 6 months of this.
No.
There you are.
No, I tried three times to unmute. I thought I was unmuted. Anyway, thanks so much. I'm glad to be here and glad to see another week of sun hit Seattle before we enter the dark days and the re-election months ahead. So let's enjoy this week.
Good to have you.
Thank you.
Writing insightful feminist critiques of the actions of our reigning chief, Big Little Hands, and the host of Vachon, Voice of Vachon's Real Talk, which follows it briefly by 15 minutes, is Susan McCabe. Who do we have to look forward to you interviewing today, Susan?
Today, I am offering everyone an option for handling the pandemic and the election insanity, shamanism.
Oh.
With Antonia Green. It might be what we all need, how to be a shaman, how to access your own shaman and make life feel good. And Lynn, you called it the re-election. That gave me chills down my spine, please.
Gods, did I say that?
Yes, you did.
Shoot me. Shoot me now.
Ear there, Susan. Sharp ear. Yeah. Goodness.
Can shamans make Lieutenant Bone Spurs go away?
Possibly.
He ought to submit to some of their techniques. If anybody saw the New York Times article on wounded warriors getting treatment in the jungles of Peru with ayahuasca, they are revisiting the 60s and the 70s research into psychoactive substances to break through the usual locked compartments PTSD can cause, causing a terrible disconnection. And so maybe if we could get some of that to President Big Hands, Little Hands, I like that. That would be useful.
Peyote on the way.
Yep.
In the form of a McDonald's burger or
calms him down and pile him up.
They're going to be arrested. You know, can't.
We're just wishing him well and healing. That's all. Moving trying right. to put a pill in his applesauce.
Moving right along. Highly visible on our Zoom screen this morning is the phantom editor of Invisible Vashon's weekly online newsletter for your consideration, Kevin Jones. Kevin, what's the next big thing on Indivisible's calendar this week?
We have sort of a walk around town and check out some of the U.S. Postal Service signs and posters that they're up in town, thanks to our good friend Charlie. And there's one by the stop sign at the post office and another one by the mailbox at the four-way stop, surprisingly. And if you go to that poster, you're going to see what's called a QR code. It sort of looks like a Rorschach test ink blot. But if you take your phone and go into photograph mode and aim it at that little ink blot, your phone will register that. And you can click on that and go to a link of the things we can do to support the post office and push back on Postmaster Louis DeJoy, who surprisingly, with all of his insight into how to resurrect the finances of the post office, doesn't know how much a 30 postcard stamp it costs these days. So anyway, yeah, check it out. Go into town. It'll be up there through the weekend. So hopefully you'll be able to do that and make some calls to save the post office.
And Kevin, I was going to ask you, I saw on TV the other, was it last night, night before? I believe it was the Lieutenant Governor of Wisconsin. And on his bookshelf, I always love seeing what people have on their bookshelves, you know, when they're doing their interviews. And on his bookshelf was Indivisible. Is there a book, Indivisible?
There is a book, yes. The two founders of Indivisible, who are somewhere in their 30-ish, 40-ish age, who were staffers for Obama, created the organization and wrote a book last year.
Oh, okay. Well, he had it on his bookshelf, so there you go.
Okay, well, a true lefty then.
In Wisconsin, more or less.
Yeah, yeah.
We need more lefties in Wisconsin, from what I can gather.
Yes, exactly. So also joining us from his book line study, and I don't see a copy of Indivisible on your bookshelf, is our retired carpenter, thespian, vocalist, and half a bubble shy of plum carpenter, Michael Shook.
You can see how I'm leaning here.
Yeah. I like that.
Thank you, Bruce. It's good to be here.
Actually, the screen reverses itself, so you're leaning to the right. and finally, I'm
bobbleheads.
Right. Yes. Finally, I'm Bruce Holman, the designated guardian of the galaxy, trying to keep some order in the midst of all the chaos we are living through right now. As an historian, I try to provide a long-range view, and the continually reminding folks that while the grinding wheels of justice. Grind.
Hang on. It's there. See, there it is.
There we are.
I was clicking, it just wasn't coming. Okay, there you go. Sorry.
Speaking of the grinding wheels of justice, what about what has happened and is happening in Kenosha, Wisconsin? Will the president's visit win or lose the election for him?
Kenosha.
It's going to bolster, it's going to do what he wants it to do, I reckon, which is to, you know, jack up his base even more and get them all fired up. But I think anyone who is even following these events with a modicum of interest has to know that Trump has been overblowing everything so much. He's just been doing what he usually does, lying constantly. So I don't think it's going to sway anybody in between.
Yeah, I think his goal is to continue to foment violence so he can push his, quote, law and order agenda to his base. I'm not sure anybody with a brain is going to actually buy that, but I've been wrong before about that.
All right. So Heather Cox Richardson says that last Thursday on Fox and Friends, Kellyanne Conway said that the more chaos and anarchy and vandalism and violence reigns, the better it is for candidate Trump, the law and order candidate. And that's right out of Kellyanne Conway's mouth. So there you go.
You know, let me add that I think, Susan, of course, you know, from a kind of a logical and certainly leftist standpoint, it seems very transparent that what he's doing is electioneering. However, I think that what he's doing is stoking fear. And fear, more than the base, is what will affect this election. If people stay home or they wobble on their opinions or they mistake some of the anarchist property damage with the Black Lives Matter justifiable protest, you know, if that all gets muddied in this, it's a setback and probably why I made my Freudian error. I hope to never say that again, but it's fear that he's stoking.
Well, and so if it's fear that works, do we encourage the Democrats to push of the loss of our democracy? I mean, which fear is greater? I presume that violence in the streets perpetrated by doctored videos and doctored quotes is a more immediate fear than the fear of authoritarian government long term. 12 more years is what they were shouting at the end.
That's the struggle. There is that. What you just raised, Susan, is really good. Conway's comments were a classic example of doublethink, saying one thing and then saying in the next breath that Trump doesn't want the violence to continue. And yet in the first part of her statement, she acknowledged that's what's going to work for him the best. So, and then when people see the violence, it's not abstract. Whoa, there's the pictures. There's the people smashing windows. There's the people burning cars. Whereas, oh my gosh, our republic is in grave danger. We have to rally to it. In a lot of people's minds, that's like, well, I don't know. I still go to the grocery store and, you know, my neighborhood isn't on fire. And that's kind of abstract.
And like climate change or climate crisis, which is what it really is.
Kevin.
You know, I think what's super helpful to me, and I think maybe really important, is that the world we're looking at, which Trump is claiming is fraught with fear and danger, is Trump's America, right? Biden made that point very clearly. And it's so easy to fall into the violence is something that would occur under Biden, when it clearly is occurring under Trump. And there's lots of policies that will, you know, manage unrest. And frankly, right, the violence in inner cities has been declining for years and years under Obama. It's only under Trump that they're reversing. So this is another matter of Trump's projection. Is any bad thing that attributes to him, he will turn right around and attribute to you. And it's very important that we realize that that's just one other manifestation. And the fear is, frankly, the thing I fear is another 4 years of what we're seeing right now, which is what Trump is bringing to us.
No kidding. You know, if you can bear with me for a sentence or two, the only thing that I have to say that is approaching a serious answer to your question, as opposed to more outrage, which is what I feel, has to do with that book that I told you I was reading called American Nations. And it talked about 11 subcultures in America. And it really emphasized the difficulty of the far West, which was not the left coast where we are, but the far West, which he said was really uninhabitable without large scale corporate involvement in mining, ranching, you know, kind of land development, all of those big concerns that had to happen to make the West viable, and that they learned sort of not to rely on government, because pretty much the only thing happening for them was the railroad coming through town, and that corporations, for good or bad, were what they had to rely on to create jobs and opportunity for a life there. And so it makes, to me, it all more understandable that the people that are seeing their way of life erode, and they don't see government as helpful, and they are fearful of globalization and a lot of the other immigrant taking jobs. I mean, I just think it's a sort of outmoded way of handling, you know, those kinds of concerns. I don't think we've come up with the answers to serving some of the people that he serves by, you know, stoking their fear and their rage and kind of promising things that we can't go back to. It's impossible. You know, they just gave approval for the coal plants to, you know, get going again under less regulation. And so I just feel like we're teetering on the past and the future. That's what it feels like, unstable.
So this is good, Lynn, because what I'm hearing you say there, or what went through my mind when I was listening to you, what are the Democrats offering, I guess, to folks? I mean, we've got that kind of dividing line, the Cascade Mountains, the Sierra Nevadas, and everything east of that, clear over to, you know, the Midwest. What are the Democrats saying? Look, here's what we can do for you to help you in your lives.
I'm not sure. I think Biden is talking a lot about infrastructure, you know, and a lot of maybe mm-hmm. that means putting people together to build bridges and roads and, you know, those kinds of things that we've neglected to put people back to work. So I don't really know. And I think that is the key to me for this election, is that we get over the not Trump and start addressing some of the economic and sort of social constructs that are complex and we just need to chip away at, but try to make them understandable to people what we can do in a short time. He just promises things that can't be done.
But what he is offering is recognition that the fossil fuel based economy or energy system that we have is one that leads to that crisis of climate change, Susan, that you mentioned. So, you know, moving towards electrification. I just, for example, saw an analysis of in Washington State, when we transition to the Clean Energy Transformation Act is going to remove all coal-based and all fossil fuel-based energy from the energy grid by 2045. And the analysis of the transmission lines needed to bring energy in from places that are east of the Cascades and east of the Sierra Nevadas is huge. There's a lot of infrastructure that we need, not only to collect the energy from the sun and the wind, but also to transport it to those high density population centers. And that doesn't even go into the notion of the, you know, rooftop solar and things of that nature. So there is a huge transition underway in addition to infrastructure like roads and bridges and all the classical stuff. So I think that's one of the policies that I look forward to with the Biden administration.
So one of the things that that I found interesting is talking about your transmission lines and all of that is that using the interstate highway system, the space between the lanes, basically, to run all of that, all those lines and everything that's already there, right-of-ways are there and everything's there, so it makes it pretty easy. But I just wanted to tell you, have any of you heard about this new company, NDB? They're making nano diamond batteries. Have you heard about these?
No.
Oh, man. This could be the biggest news of the decade. These folks have, what they do is they take carbon-14 that's been irradiated, so it's radioactive. They're control rods out of nuclear reactors and the like. They compress this carbon into diamonds. Into a diamond material. When they do that, it encapsulates the radiation, so they're not radioactive then. But those diamonds produce electricity, and they have figured out a way to layer these guys and to collect the electricity out of them, so they can make a battery that never needs to be recharged and will last 28,000 years.
So all the hippies with their crystal power.
That's right. That's right. Dilithium crystals. There we are. You know, Star Trek had it. No, this is pretty mind-boggling. They have figured out, I mean, they've known for a long time that, you know, these diamonds did produce electricity, but there was only about, they could only collect about 15% of the output, so it's not really usable. They've got it up to 40%, and they say all you need is air, and the natural air. I don't understand the technology, but basically
is it on the stock exchange yet?
It is. they're looking for private investors. And believe me, if I had an extra $50K laying around, I would jump on it. Because it could be the thing that we've been looking for. Pretty amazing.
What is the name?
Pretty amazing. Okay. NDB. Look it up. NDB battery or NDB company on the internet. Yes.
Battery encased in diamonds uses nuclear waste to power devices for thousands of years on a single charge.
That's the one. Well, it's not a single charge. There's no charge. It makes its own electricity. Anyway, yeah. Pretty amazing.
Then they'll be bought out and run out of business by people like General Electric.
I don't think so.
They don't want the competition.
There's some big bucks back in these guys.
Don't go the dark way there, Lynn. Don't go the dark way.
Well, you know, no, she's right, though. You know, that's happened many times in the past.
Politics.
Yeah, yeah. Kevin?
If we allow it.
There you go. I agree.
We've regulated capitalism before for the good of our society, and we can do it again. And Truman, what you're saying is this kind of stuff is really exciting because it's the kind of thing that people have been tearing their hair out. I tore all mine out, you can see. But in despair. But these are the kinds of technologies that are going to come online over the next 20 years that are going to make a dramatic difference for the good in our fight against, you know, to tame somewhat climate change.
There are some really interesting challenges out there, like, you know, how to electrify air travel and things like that. But another technology, and right south of us, I believe centered in Portland, is the Renewable Hydrogen Alliance. And we've heard about hydrogen cells powering cars. But with hydrogen, you can create basically any one of the fuels like propane and so on, because it's basically a combination of carbon and hydrogen. So if you can create hydrogen, which you can from electrolysis, it turns out, apparently to the expert that I've talked to, the Germans had to do this in World War II when the Allies cut them off from the oil fields. They had to go to some other way to generate energy. And so many of the electrolysis processes have German names because that's how they created energy to sustain the war effort. And so the idea of electrolysis is you have water and energy, and you can create hydrogen by splitting the H2O into hydrogen and oxygen. The deal is that we have so much electricity in California during the summertime right now with all the solar panels that they have, that energy basically goes to waste. You have to pay people to take it away. If you can use it to generate fuel like hydrogen, all of a sudden you've created an economy. You put a price floor underneath this electricity, so the investors keep wanting to build more, right? And so there's lots and lots of really exciting ways to find alternatives to fossil fuels.
It seems like it's such a race against time, and I think partially that's what drives my anxiety. You know, it's not just that there is one terrible presidential election coming up, you know, upon which so much rides. It's that parallel to this, you know, the climate change is happening all around us. You know, look at Lake Charles. You know, I have a lot of friends down, you know, in that area. And so we're always on the phone when all these, you know, powerful storms come by. And, you know, Lake Charles is just utterly and totally devastated, you know, as much as New Orleans was in the Katrina thing. And, you know, so to me, it's a matter of maintaining the hope and the creativity and the development that America is so great at, and, you know, putting our bets there and hoping that we can outrun what is happening, you know, with the climate change and stabilize things as soon as we can.
Susan.
And I think we need to remove the chains of capitalism so that those alternative energy sources can truly be developed. And there's beyond alternative energies, there's so many ways to change agriculture so that it sequesters carbon and pulls carbon out of the air. And yeah, it's absolutely a race against time. We are there now. We are seeing climate crisis happen before our very eyes. But it's yeah, this election and some sort of regulation, I guess it is, of capitalism, some sort of reining in of capitalism or using capitalism to allow and encourage the development of alternatives. I think that's also dependent on our changing our tax structure so that it incentivizes alternatives as opposed to incentivizing the status quo.
Yes.
So you're talking about the election coming up. You just came out of two conventions, the Republican convention last week and the week before the Democratic convention. What's your sense of who won? Which convention was better? Which convention sort of mobilized its base best? And did virtual conventions work? Susan?
I'm blabbing a lot today, but as a producer, they were both infomercials. I think the convention was remarkably effective in the way that they produced it. I suspect they had a lot of help from professionals in Hollywood, but they did a darn good job of spreading hope, of showcasing their candidates, and of showcasing the diversity of the Democratic Party. I think the Republicans clunked along and were embarrassing, but I only watched it, the first half hour of it, and then some of the highlights. I was particularly impressed by the Barbie doll women who spoke with the same hairstyle, the same red dress with uplifting breasts, and the same...
I think you mean uplifted breasts. Yes, they are uplifting.
They were quite uplifting.
And uplifting.
For Trump, they were uplifting.
I was uplifting a lot, yeah.
Sorry, you were making such a good point.
Sorry, yeah.
At least he constrained himself and didn't grab him, right?
That's right. That's right.
Not on camera, anyway.
That's my take on him.
Sorry, Susan. Now you were saying before you were so rudely interrupted.
I'm sorry,
Kevin.
I think you are pointing out the Fox News model for success there. I was just so happy that the Republican convention met its goal of being so uplifting and positive and joyful.
Sorry.
We can detect the cynicism there. I also thought it was great that almost every Trump person has something good to say about Donald, at least the ones that were on television, right? They didn't bring his sister, the judge, who I think was quoted as something like he's crazy, or his niece who wrote the book about how the Trump family had basically, stolen her heritage. it was pretty much the Trump train all over. On steroids, I'd say.
So what's your feelings about using the White House and, as political backdrop?
That's what I was going to say, is that I was really offended by the bully pulpit, which he already has, and he can talk about his platforms or his reactions to things, all he wants already. And then they use the White House, Rose Garden, in the White House, some of the lawn for their, convention speeches and stuff. And, he just has no idea about ethics and boundaries, none. And I feel that, this cavalier disregard for some of those separations and boundaries of church and state, of,
just decorum,
disadvantages of people being, yeah. Yeah, that's good. I just think he's exploiting everything, you know, the sorrow people have and all of that.
When he said, "I'm here and you're not," that was over the top. Give me a break.
Exactly.
And but to go back historically too, I can't relinquish hope and faith in enough people treasuring our republic and trying to do what's right. I mean, we're all so fallible, but we've been in some grim situations before. I was reading something again. Bruce, we can rely on you, I'm sure, here for the historical context of this. But I remember reading that I think before the Civil War, there were pistols drawn in the House of Representatives. Yeah. I mean, it was we think it's warfare now. These guys were ready to shoot each other. So Trump is just being the sociopath that he is.
Susan.
In the book, How Democracies Die, the continued health of a democracy, he describes, is dependent on something he calls forbearance among legislators. And that is, forbearance is defined, and Kevin, you can correct me if I've got this wrong, is defined as some adherence to a certain amount of decorum in legislation. In addition to that, And when that is not adhered to, it chips away at democracy. The other piece of it is the incredible increase of executive power that started before Trump that allows him to take executive actions and go around Congress. And the fact that our checks and balances are not working because he has the Justice Department under his purview. Yeah. Thank you. So that confluence of the lack of forbearance among him and his legislators or sycophants, the lack of the checks and balances in operation, and the extreme growth of executive power is eroding our democracy right before our eyes.
I thank you, Susan. I really agree with all of that. And you know how we've talked before on this place about civics and civics education, and why is it that nobody is stopping any of this? I mean, is it ignorance? Is it just, you know, kowtowing to his political power? But I'm saying this for a reason, because the thing that I really enjoyed reading in the New York Times on Sunday was a tiny little article about a new book by a young man called Ben Sheehan, who wants to explain to young people how government works and agrees that there has been no civics education in schools or very little for 20 years. And so I want to tell you what the title of this book is, because people need to look it up. Young people, it's called OMG, WTF Does the Constitution Actually Say? And their group who wrote this book is called OMG WTF, which anybody who texts knows what that means. But what they say it stands for is Ohio, Michigan, Georgia, Wisconsin, Texas, and Florida, which are some of the swing states. And his point is that if people don't get sophisticated about politics, not just separating fact from fiction, but understanding separation of powers, understanding ethics, understanding, you know, the active role that we have in any democracy. I think it's wonderful that they have made education for civics. I'd like to get this book and look at it, because it needs to be brought back to young people, and it needs to be brought back in a way that's funny and exemplary and not dry. So I like that. That was my humor for the week. OMG WTF. That's the title of my week.
About education. Yesterday was the first day of school on Vashon.
Yes.
What do we think about online education? Is it the future? Will we ever go back to kids in classrooms again? Or what do you think?
Well, it's a laudable idea, and I'm glad that school districts are trying to do something. Personally, I feel like give the kids the whole year off. It's not there. Nobody's going to be irretrievably damaged. You know, that said, the online stuff is great, but we're going to have to figure out a way if that's going to be a significant or even a small part of education, then we gotta get internet service for everybody. We gotta get people access to it, because if you don't have a nice little laptop and a good strong signal, it's like, well, sorry, bye bye.
Yeah, the Vashon School District has given every student a new laptop.
Wow.
Bainbridge gave their kids all new iPads.
But how, but then, so there you are supposed, you know, here you got kids in, South Detroit or something, you know, how many of them are, does the school district even have enough money? You know, we're lucky here because this is a pretty well off school district.
Susan.
Yeah, I think online education is probably going to stay with us, at least in part, for a while. I heard today about something called unschooling, which is oddly happening among lower socioeconomic groups and people of color. And it's basically the way it was, this is my description, it's more like individualized education, where parents are keeping kids home. They have to register as homeschooling, but they keep kids home and they allow their kids to supervise and conduct their own education so that they can, for instance, take a research topic as far as they want to. Mm-hmm. And apparently this has been going on for a while, and those who are unschooled tend to do as well or better than those who've gone through the public school system after they get out of school. Kind of surprising, but an interesting.
You know, I have seen and experienced that working really well with some kids who don't want or need all the socialization and who are at an older age. I think young kids, though, need to be in a group setting. They need some socialization, and they need a lot of the other types of education they get by being in a classroom. But, you know, so I don't know that it will stick around for little young kids whose brains aren't really developed for fast moving, kind of sit still concentration stuff. It'll be interesting to see how that goes. My daughter is lucky. They make so much money. They have bonded with another family that has kids their kids' age, and they are hiring a teacher at her salary.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So, now, there you go with a two-tiered educational system. The people in Detroit and the people, you know, who have money to do whatever needs to be done. It's heartbreaking. I'm, of course, glad for my grandkids, but wow.
So have you guys followed the Khan Academy or the work of Salman Khan? It's very, very interesting. I'm trying to remember. I think he was like a stock trader or some. He had some position on Wall Street, but he had a niece and nephew that were like in Oklahoma or somewhere, way away from him, and they were having trouble with math, and so he sat down and did some YouTube videos explaining these math concepts, and it became so popular, Bill Gates saw it, and he was, you know, totally fascinated with it, and he funded this guy, and now the Khan Academy, it's K-A-H-N, is really huge, and many of school systems are adopting his method, and what they're doing, I find this really fascinating. Instead of doing homework and then coming into school to get the lessons, they do their lessons at home on their computers. And when they come to school, they do their homework, in that what they do there is they review the stuff that they've learned, and they use peer-to-peer teaching to help the kids that really get it in a hurry, help the kids that don't in that classroom situation. And it's hugely successful. And I can see it being used in this new, you know, stay-at-home learning.
That's a great point. Yeah. I mean, the idea of being able to have world-class experts explain math to you right there did it for me, because I had a terrible math teacher and I never mastered the foundations of anything complicated in math. So that would be great. And thanks for bringing that in.
Yeah, look it up, Khan Academy.
Kevin. You know, it seems like, Truman, that's a, to sort of think through all of the things that students need, right, to gain an education. And as Lynn, you mentioned, it's socialization as well as knowledge, right, and how to apply knowledge. And I've only spent a little time working in our supporting our school district, but was really impressed with the skills and the insight that the educators had in evaluating how the students were doing, right? And so the idea, though, Truman, and what you said was, if you can create, you know, networks of peers mm-hmm. who are working together,
yeah,
right, that can perhaps replace that or substitute somewhat for that teacher oversight. I just think that the current situation just does put a burden on parents substantially, right, to now share that workload of helping their students come up that those learning curves. That might be a net benefit, right, of parents becoming more involved in kids' education, you know, in the long run. I certainly think on Vashon, you know, this notion that we're a safe place so we don't have to have online education, it ignores the all of the students that come over from Seattle. So I think it's really important that what they do here on Vashon is have a distance and stay safe so that we can maintain that you know, that base of students and the curriculum that it brings.
I think as a single mom growing up, you know, I have a different perspective. You know, my daughter was the only child of a single mom. And I would not have been able to choose to stay home to educate her at the expense of losing my job and my health insurance and all of that. So I think that's the dilemma. I think this idea of remote learning is I don't want to say the word elitist, but I mean, it makes a lot of assumptions about who's home to do that and what resources they have to do that, both educationally and socially themselves. And I think, yes, ideally, wouldn't it be nice to have, you know, your parents all around helping you all the time? But it's, you know, we're in the middle of an economic crisis as well. And these people are eager to get back to work. So I personally see a push for getting little kids back in the classrooms as soon as possible. And, you know, not devastating people who, you know, rely on one income or low income jobs to be able to take on the job as educators. I'm sorry. That's just
that's the burden that I was talking about. Yeah. It's a huge burden on families. And some, as you mentioned, Lynn, right, have economic wherewithal and they can handle that by various means. But some put them in probably really desperate straits.
Yeah.
So
one potential advantage I see of online learning that definitely will have to be combined with in-person education is some sense of continuing to keep people excited about learning. And I think there are aspects of traditional public education that squash that make learning boring or a chore. So anything I think that can encourage curiosity and enthusiasm for learning is a good thing.
You know, I have one just real quick thing, and that is one of the things that all of this education that we're talking about is people engaging in their own development. And one of the things that we hardly do anymore is teaching rote things, rote memorization. And you, Bruce, as a historian, I'm finding that when I see a date, I now try and go back and relate. When was the Civil War? What are they talking about? When did that happen? Because the context of that makes it much more real. And I think we're missing that in our today's education process. So
Anyway, hey, guys, we're out of time. We've got 2 seconds. We'll see you all next week.
Hey.